good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, but hold your calls for the time being, and please don't call in unless we specifically ask, because we have with us this evening, on the line from Minnesota, Michael Trudeau of Colonial Resources. Michael, how are you this evening?
I am wonderful, Stan. How about yourself?
Oh, I'm doing just fine. Well, as we look around and see what's happening in the country, I figure that we are indeed very, very fortunate compared with the tragic people there in Louisiana and certainly in adjacent Mississippi, and we relatively untouched by what's happened there other than the rising in price of oil. But I hear with people with shattered lives who've lost their homes and lost their jobs and lost their possessions, and we're speaking of hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Americans who are refugees in their own country.
Sure. The thing that shocked me as I watched it unfold was the scope of this. And I think the first thing that impacted me was when they began showing some of the actual Gulfport, Mississippi shots. And they had showed, I think, probably 5, 6, 7 miles inland, and literally not a stick was standing still. And I was thinking, boy, this looks like the aftermath of Hiroshima or Nagasaki after something like that happened. I called my mom right on that spot and said, you know, I need a bit of a reality check here because I'm 43 and I know you've got me by a good couple of decades. Is this the worst thing that's ever happened in my lifetime on American soil? She said, Mikey, it's the worst thing that's happened on American soil in just about anybody's lifetime. And as I've watched this thing unfold, it really has separated, I think, or shown us the massive separation between good and evil. Because here in one spot, one location, you can watch as it unfolds and see how some people tip to one side immediately and begin looting and doing horrific, unspeakable things. Well, on the other side, you see neighbors helping neighbors and people who, when they do get power restored, immediately begin stringing electrical cords to their neighbors' houses and so on, and helping people by rescuing pets and taking people in. You can see that separation. It's so fine and it's so vast at the same time. It's just shocking.
Well, the nice thing is I think that the vast majority of Americans are wonderful, wonderful people, but there's always that small minority that certainly will use something like this, an opportunity to, as you say, do evil.
And it was just something that was appalling to watch some of the atrocities that were occurring, you know.
Well, you know, of course, this is all going to have a tremendous impact, not only on the lives of those people, but really on our country. We've got about three major things happening now. We have the impact of Katrina, which is going to add probably 500,000 people to the unemployment rolls and cost. They're talking about, a couple of hundred billion dollars to, undo all the damage that's been done there.
Where do we get that $200 billion from?
Well, see, that's the thing that I don't think most people ever stop and ask is, the president's already agreed to spend some over $60 billion. The government doesn't have any money. The government doesn't have any money, but what it takes from us by taxes, what it borrows from other countries or from our people, or what it creates simply by printing money and inflating the money supply, and of course laying the foundation for disaster. And we have never been in a situation as we are today with having the massive debts where we're totally dependent upon foreign countries to buy our bonds to keep this country and our economy from collapsing. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Michael Trudeau as we begin exploring what's happening financially and the three great catastrophes we face: the rising price of oil, Katrina, and of course, I believe, a collapsing housing market. Well, Michael, those are the three things. I think the other fourth thing that is really a major problem for America, besides Katrina, rising price of oil, the housing bubble, which I think is beginning to implode, but then the devastating effect of the World Trade Organization, open borders, globalization on the destruction of the industrial infrastructure of America. I think that these things are going to really play havoc with the financial stability of our nation and really everybody listening to the program this evening.
No question. One of the things that I find actually kind of perplexing at the moment as I try to sort this out is if we look at where the housing market was headed, and of course we know it's a bubble, you and I and plenty of the people out here in the listening audience know it's an overinflated bubble. I think some of the peak areas in California and Florida are overinflated by 69 and 68% respectively. But what you see as the pinprick for that bubble is the rising interest rates. And the Fed, of course, has to raise those interest rates because if they don't, they cannot satisfy those very Asian countries that are buying our debts, if you will, or buying those bonds and so on. So they've got to be raising those interest rates, which is the pin that's just poised so closely to that balloon, the housing balloon, that we're sitting on because, of course, as you're aware, if they raise interest rates, it pushes those people who are on those floating arm mortgages out further than what they can pay, and they have to begin just kind of turning the keys over to the house to the banks. What's interesting about this all, though, is now comes Katrina, and here comes the curveball in all of this, because now what you've got is this situation because of the economic impact where the Fed might actually have to put the brakes on the interest rate rising. Now, having said that, if they do hit the skids on those interest rates, that is going to bode very poorly for the dollar. It will bode very well, obviously, for gold. But what you will see is that at that point, you're going to see those other countries that are out there holding our debt instruments start going, now, wait a minute, you guys were keeping me happy there by throwing those interest rates out there and raising those interest rates, and I'm looking for the future interest rates, and I'm hedging my bets against that, and now all of a sudden you're telling me you're going to stop raising those rates. These are these foreign nations now holding these debts. And, of course, they all want to be, you know, a good neighbor and help out with this economic impact from Katrina, but they're only willing to help out so long as it doesn't mean the collapse of their own economies. And, of course, at this point, that's poised very dangerously. And when you look at some of the impact headlines coming out of Katrina, and just from the last time that we've spoke, of course, in the last couple of weeks, some of these headlines are pretty scary. Here's one off of CNN. Insurer Katrina, largest loss ever. Hurricane Katrina is the costliest disaster ever, with the insurance industry slice of the cleanup bill reaching as much as $50 billion. Here's one off of MSNBC. As you pointed out, some of this information, impoverished evacuees.
Hold that thought there for just a moment, Michael, as we begin to come to the point when we're going to bring our other stations right back on board. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this evening is Michael Trudeau from the Colonial Resources. And Michael is simply talking about already what Katrina is going to cost in the way of, insurance industry, because we're talking $50 billion. Probably that's a gross understatement. That may, but certainly the flood insurance certainly the housing destruction insurance, the loss of so many homes in New Orleans, and who's going to pick this up? A lot of the people there, they probably will just simply walk away from their homes and leave the companies, the lending companies, the banks holding the bag as far as the rest of the money. So, and of course, what's the bank going to do with his home now that's water soaked? That it certainly can't be rehabilitated.
Right.
Go ahead, Michael.
Well, it's basically rubble. You've hit the nail right on the head. Is, of course, as these people walk away from these homes, this is not as if these homes had been paid for fully, and then somebody says, "Well, that's that. I guess my home's kind of destroyed by this water. I'm just going to go ahead and leave it." This is, of course, the situation where everybody's home down there predominantly is owned by the bank, and these people will stop making those mortgage payments and simply say, yeah, go ahead and repossess the house. Foreclose on me. Obviously, I can't pay this, and obviously, I don't want that house. So you're right. The banks are the ones that will be, holding the bag on that, and that's going to have a massive impact aside from some of these obvious impacts. And again, as as we pointed out coming out of that break, of course, Katrina is the largest loss ever in terms of the insurance industry, and it's, the cleanup bill reaching as high as $50 billion. Again, off of MSNBC, impoverished evacuees begin looking for work. Hurricane Katrina's victims give up on quick return to homes and former jobs. And, of course, when we start talking about that amount of people suddenly unemployed, it's a pretty large impact. One of the things that I saw today that I found interesting was a poll that CNN was doing that just basically asked the question, will Katrina help send the United States into a period of higher inflation. And 73% of the Americans polled here had said yes, they expect that this will go into a higher period of inflation due to Katrina. And that's impacted because of the fact that that's also going to have an effect on consumer confidence. If you've got 73% of the Americans already admitting that, yeah, this is going to have an impact on us in the inflation area, that of course, this is going to be something to be afraid of. Down the line, CNN, another one, Katrina's growing economic impact, gas prices only tip of the iceberg as deadly storm will affect real estate, trade, heating costs. And that's another one. When people start to get into this cold weather season and realize that their home heating bills are probably going to jump at least 50%, or people who are heating with natural gas are probably going to see maybe a 20% to 30% increase, this is going to have a pretty large impact on people's lives across the northern half of this country, where we didn't see any effect physically from Katrina.
And I really think that there's so very many, many things that are really going to be impact on every aspect of our lives. I don't think people realize what's going to happen as far as the hauling of goods. Certainly, you know, with the $3 a gallon, the $3.25 a gallon for diesel fuel, you're talking about almost a 50% increase in the cost of diesel fuel, you know. And I think they've been putting out maybe $30 or $40 million a year, I don't know. But anyway, dramatic increases, you know, in the cost of hauling items. The same thing is going to impact on our already beleaguered airlines, which, of course, are going to have to pay more for their fuel. Sure. And all of these airlines are really on the verge of bankruptcy, whether it be Delta, Northwest. You know, United certainly has been in and out of bankruptcy. People don't really understand what's happening, that these companies, many of them really would almost welcome a bankruptcy because that's the way they could get out from underneath their pension obligations. We've never been in a situation as we are today. In fact, everybody should read the speech was given at Jackson Hole, Wyoming, by Alan Greenspan, where he openly talks about the fact that the reason they lowered the interest rates was because they were afraid that they were going to see deflation. So they had to lower the interest rates. And now we're raising the interest rates again to try to get some stability in the monetary markets. But we are in totally uncharted waters. And as he said, we really don't know what's going to happen as all these artificial asset bubbles, whether it be the housing bubble or the stock market bubble, these other asset bubbles that created this liquidity based upon absolutely nothing, when these begin to contract. And you know, we could just see the tone, you know, of his speech, although it's difficult to figure out what Alan Greenspan is saying. But if you sit there with a yellow pen and underline what he's saying, we are in real trouble, and we don't know what's going to happen because we've never been here before.
Well, you're right. One of the things that I've been thinking about as I've been reading about some of the commentary that's been coming out of Greenspan, and from our last conversation on the program when we talked about the fact that Greenspan had made that famous 1965 speech about deficit spending stealing the wealth and gold stopping that process, you'd made the comment that he had later in life, just a couple of years ago, even been asked by, I believe it was Congressman Ron Paul, whether or not that was accurate as to whether or not he still felt that way, and he'd made the statement that, yes, that's correct, I still feel that way. And now there's kind of this underlying hint right now coming out of the Fed that says, hey, we're kind of getting ready to put this guy out to pasture. And while that's happening, and you can kind of see these hints coming, and they're actually making comments about it now, is you can kind of feel that Greenspan's kind of saying, I've kept my mouth shut about this long enough because I've been the head of the Fed, and before I go out, and while I've still got the public's eye, I'm going to tip people off. And in that very speech that you quoted from out in Jackson, Wyoming, he'd made the comment that really caught my attention, where he said you shouldn't count on paper wealth, which can evaporate if economic conditions deteriorate rapidly. What you perceive as newly abundant liquidity can readily disappear. And boy, when you hear something like that coming from what would be the chairman of the Federal Reserve, you have to, just as you pointed out, if you're underlining with that yellow pen, you really have to sit back in the chair and go, huh, is this guy trying to say something between the lines, only not so much between the lines here? I mean, that statement, as far as I'm concerned, coming from Greenspan, comes right between the eyes, not between the lines. When you hear him say, hey, you shouldn't count on paper wealth, this is the head of the paper world making that statement.
Well, I think it's very interesting, just for our listeners who are not acquainted with Alan Greenspan's speech, an article that he wrote back in 1965. Let me briefly read it to you. In the absence of the gold standard, There is no way to protect savings from confiscation through inflation. There is no safe store of value. If there were, the government would have to make its holding illegal, as was done in the case of gold. The financial policy of the welfare state requires that there be no way for the owners of wealth to protect themselves. This is the shabby secret of the welfare state's tirade against gold. Deficit spending is simply a scheme for the confiscation of wealth. Deficit spending is simply a scheme for the confiscation of wealth. Now, that's quite a statement at 1965, Alan Greenspan. But as you mentioned, I had actually called Congressman Ron Paul's office, and his press secretary confirmed that the story was true, that Ron Paul had asked Alan Greenspan a few years ago, about 2 years ago, after a meeting, how he felt about that article he'd written in 1965, if he was ready to simply reject that or repudiate that statement. And Greenspan's reply was, and I quote, "I just recently reread the article, and I wouldn't change one word of it." Now, realize the implications of what he's saying. He's saying that really we're facing a situation where deficit spending is a means of stealing people's wealth, and gold is really the only thing that's going to give us stability. And here's one of the most powerful men in the world making that statement. I think that that should give all of us real reason for thought and concern.
Well, and the other thing that you've talked about many times on this program, I've heard you many times reflecting on the fact that we hear the inflation rate is 3%, and you hear it from every sector. What, 3% inflation, 3% inflation, 3% inflation, when you and I both know, and everybody out there who tries to buy anything that you need to live on, we're not talking 3%. All you have to do is say to yourself, well, you know, what was I paying for gasoline last year at this exact time? What was I paying for my food bill at this exact time? What was I paying for, you know, my kids' schooling and my health insurance premiums and all of these things? And you can see that this is not a 3% inflation we're talking. And the Fed's numbers, when they talk about dollar devaluation, which they claim is different, is 12%. We're losing 12% of the dollar's buying power annually, 12.5% roughly. And when we look at that and hear them say 3% inflation, you kind of got to scratch your head. But what was interesting was New York Times article last month kind of came out with these new CPI numbers talking about here's where inflation is over the last 6 months. And for the United States, they point at it as being at 5%, which was interesting because it's pretty much been 3% for as far back as I can remember. But they started throwing out some of the inflation rates of some of the other nations in case we had some interest. Venezuela, 15%. Russia, 12.5%. Argentina and Brazil are at 9.6%. Indonesia, Turkey, and the Philippines are at 8% inflation. I mean, this is some pretty large numbers. These are not, you know, as the article points out, not wimpy numbers. So apparently, you know, Greenspan's right on the money. Things are not looking real rosy economically. Listen to some of these other articles. Durable orders plunge. Orders for big-ticket items post far sharper decline than Wall Street forecasts. And when we look at some of these things, these durable items, these durable goods, if you will, these things that are supposed to last for the long term, one of the large ones that was on there number-wise, as you pointed out with the airlines being in trouble, was non-defense aircraft. The non-defense aircraft orders have plunged by 20%. And you look at, you know, as you pointed out, Northwest and Delta, of course, Delta is now rattling the bankruptcy saber. Northwest is threatening with bankruptcy, of course, and they're currently under a mechanics strike. So, you know, this is not boding well for the future of the airlines industry, and if that goes down, it's going to hurt us absolutely. And another one out, just from this week, U.S. productivity growth slows. So we are slowing down, there's no question about it.
And, of course, Northwest is demanding that the flight attendants take a 20% cut in pay, you know, from about $46,000, I think, to about $36,000 a year in pay. And they're just saying, take it or leave it. And really, they're making almost impossible demands as far as the pensions and other things on their employees, because if the employees say no, then they go into bankruptcy and the employees lose their pensions. They're turned over to the government. They'll get, you know, 30 cents on the dollar on that. So really, what we're seeing is an organized effort to lower the living standards of our people. And that is exactly what you would expect. I believe so much of what's going on is preparing us for lower living standards as we redistribute the wealth of the American people throughout the world. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Michael Trudeau from Colonial Resources, and we're simply talking about what's really going on in our country today. One of the interesting things is what's happening to our agriculture. Certainly, agriculture has done fairly well in America for many years. We've been able to, compete very effectively throughout the world, but usually because we subsidized our wheat. And, of course, then we could dump it on the world and drive the farmers in other countries, into bankruptcy. But now, as they're beginning to cut back on the subsidies for our major crops, suddenly we are unable to compete with the rest of the world. And certainly here in California, a large apple-growing area. But now they're bringing in a massive amounts of apple concentrate from China and from other countries throughout the world. And simply they are undercutting the entire apple juice market. And they're doing with this with other fruit juices. And so what they're really doing, as long as we have no tariffs and they can produce these products over in China or any place else in the world, why the market balance is shifting and shifting dramatically. I think that most people really don't understand. The purpose of this globalization is intentionally to redistribute the wealth of the world. And what they're talking about is not redistributing the wealth of other countries, but redistributing America's wealth as we begin to impoverish the American people.
Well, you've really hit the nail there, too, as well, because I'll tell you, this is one of those things where you finally sit down and go, huh, so we're the largest debtor nation on the planet now, suddenly. Well, where did that come from, and how did that happen? I mean, here I am. I've been on the planet since 1962, and I can literally say, hey, we've become the largest debtor nation on the planet. How did we let ourselves get there?
Well, I think we've actually the largest debtor nation in the world's history. No other country, a strong country, has ever been in debt to all the rest of the world, and this is exactly where we are today.
Right. We should be the guys loaning out the money, It just is really amazing to me. And you can really see this impact around you. And again, as we've pointed out, that this economy is not doing well. And, you can see it everywhere in the price of oil, in the price of the housing market. You can certainly see it in the price of gold, which is certainly going to be breaking the news all over the place now, with gold breaking 450 a couple of times. It's testing that 450 barrier. Little profit taking today, but it closed at 449.30. And I think it's probably poised for a pretty large run, especially if it comes down to the Fed saying, what we're going to do here is we're going to stall out on these interest rates for a bit and let the economic impact kind of slow down here from Katrina. That's going to push the dollar down, as I pointed out, and of course at that point gold's going to run. If we look back in history now with what's going on with the dollar, there's been about a 12% decline annually for about the last 5 years. And you can mirror it with just about anything you look at. The housing market up about 50% in 5 years. If you look at, again, another good barometer, of course, the other one would be oil, but that's outpacing that a little bit, especially with the Katrina issue and with the fact that there's this issue with peak oil to discuss. But if you look to gold, it's certainly also a good barometer, again, up roughly about 70% in that same five-year period. So you can see the dollars decline all around you, and there's very little to hide your money into at this point for protection. And it's something that is really rapidly beginning to escalate, and it's something that's getting harder and harder to ignore and deny. And one of the things that I found that I thought was interesting, there's an article up on Kitco talking about the real lesson from Katrina. And what they talked about, of course, was that, these guys down here had been playing roughly, a game of what would amount to hurricane Russian roulette, knowing that the levees were not built to withstand Category 4 and that one would eventually come. Nothing happened until 2005.
Hold that thought there for just a moment, Michael, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. I guess this evening, Michael Trudeau from Colonial Resources. We're just talking about where we stand today as far as our economy is concerned. And, of course, Katrina is going to have a massive impact on our economy. They're talking at least $200 billion simply to rebuild. And then there are going to be the massive insurance payoffs that are going to have to come from the insurance companies taking liquidity out of the market. And then, of course, the rising price of oil. Oil had hit $70 a barrel. It's backed off a little bit. Everything would suggest, especially with the fact that the rest of the world needs oil, that there's going to be progressive pressure on the oil prices. In fact, there's a book out talking about Hubert's Peak, and written by an associate of a Dr. Hubert. And he's anticipating doctor, I believe it's Davis is his name, but he's predicting that the price of oil, and this was several years ago, would peak in late 2005 or 2006. Pardon me, this would be the production of world oil and then begin to decline. Very similar to Hoover's prediction back in 1956 that the U.S. oil production would peak in 1971, which it did, and natural gas production peaked at that time. Well, the predictions are that world oil production will peak in later this year or early next year. And should that happen, we would have limited supplies. What do you do with limited supplies? Why, of course, increase the price. And that will have a profound impact on our economy and on the economy of the rest of the world. And then, of course, we see the effect of globalization. We see the housing market. And if you're looking across this country, why the price of apartments in New York has dropped a couple of $100,000. Of course, they were about $1,350,000. Or you can pick them up cheap for $1,150,000. Now, hardly a drop, but we're seeing more and more houses on the market that is just not moving.
Well, you're right, and one of the things that we're touching on now with this peak oil situation is how large of an impact this will be on people, because I don't think people really realize how big of an impact it will be, and maybe they do realize it, and it's one of those things where you just got to have to say it's too much information. Carl Jung, one of the fathers of psychology, famously remarked that people cannot stand too much reality, and I think that might be what's going on here with this one, because again, this is a big one, and this is one of those things where it doesn't matter who you ask, it doesn't matter which side of the political arena, it doesn't matter what scientific community you test the waters on, when you talk about the peak oil issue, they all come back and say, yeah, this one's for real. And again, this is one of those things where people start going, well, it's going to really impact my commute to work, and it's going to do this, and it's going to do that, but I think what people need to realize is how big of an impact it's going to have besides just your commuting. Give you an example of what I mean by this. In the United States, 400 gallons of oil equivalents are expended annually to feed each American. So each one of us, and there's, 310 million of us, each one of us requires 400 gallons of oil just to eat every year. The breakdown on that, just so you've got it, 31% for the manufacture of inorganic fertilizer, 19% for the operation of field machinery, 16% for the transportation, 13% for irrigation. The rest goes basically for raising livestock, but doesn't include livestock feed, crop drying, pesticide production, 0.8% miscellaneous. This also, I should point out, does not factor in packaging, refrigeration, and transportation to retail outlets, as well as household cooking. So again, those factors aren't even involved in this when I say that each one of us consumes 400 gallons of oil equivalents just to feed us. So it's not about just gasoline getting to and from work. This is a much larger scope than that. And the other thing that people fail to realize is that it can't be fixed so easily. You hear all of the people who will come back and say, well, we'll just go to solar. And the problem with going to solar is, in order for you, you have to think like this in this kind of a scope. How much petroleum and how much energy would it take us to then manufacture at the current levels of what our solar cells are capable of, which isn't very energy efficient, by the way. But if you took it where it was today and said, well, we need to outfit every home on the planet with solar so that we can get by this oil problem. And then you start to think about how much oil it would take to do just that. And you quickly come to the realization that we won't be able to actually manufacture enough solar panels for this. Same problem with any kind of wind generation. When you look to things like one of the arguments about, well, we're certainly going to go into these energy cell production for the cars. None of this is going to work because, again, the problem is you have to continually come up with the energy to create them. Even if you go nuclear, same problem. It takes tremendous amounts of energy to produce the uranium to fuel these plants. So we're really in a bind here.
Well, I think the thing is that as people are spending more and more money for gasoline and for heating oil and for electricity, they're not going to have the money to spend on other things. And they're not buying things at Walmart and at Target or at Home Depot. Then, of course, we begin to see falling demand. And that is, of course, the real problem. The one thing the economist fears more than anything is if people quit buying and prices then competitively begin to fall and you have deflation. And nothing will strike fear in the hearts of the economist more than thought of inflation or deflation right here in America. Thank you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and of course our guest this evening is Michael Trudeau from Colonial Resources. We're talking about what's happening to the economy and really the major threats we have now. Katrina, rising oil prices, a globalization, and a housing bubble that is simply that. It's simply a bubble that has created tremendous asset value with absolutely nothing behind it. Because, you know, true wealth has nothing to do with what people will pay for a product. True wealth is something of inherent value. And the value of the houses that have been being sold today for $500,000 or $1 million or $2 or $3 million has nothing to do with their true value. It's only speculative. And when the speculator suddenly realizes that maybe he's going to get stuck with a house that he's paid an awful lot for and he can't turn around and sell it and get his money out, then of course, we begin competitive selling. So pick up the story there.
Well, you know, we were touching on the peak oil issue, and one of the things that you had brought up in the very beginning of the discussion was that basically the peak in 1970 happened here in America, which is correct. I mean, obviously, you know, we were producing somewhere in the neighborhood of about 11 million barrels a day in 1970, and since then production has dropped steadily. As of 2004, we were just at about the 5 million barrel a day mark, which is a significant number because we consume roughly 20 million barrels a day. So we're now importing about two-thirds of our oil. Ratio is going to continue to worsen. But as you pointed out, the peak being in 1970, it's very interesting to watch what has actually developed since then, because you've seen a change in geoeconomic power. Within a few years, foreign producers, basically OPEC, setting the price of oil and in turn leading the oil crisis of the 1970s. In response, you get frantic development of non-OPEC oil, especially in the North Sea fields of England and Norway. And basically that saves our back end for about 20 years. But I want to point something out about that, because since 1999, these fields have entered depletion. Well, there was an article that I found that I found shocking and alarming, because this goes back a couple of years to Thursday, December 2nd, 2003, from The Guardian over in England. And what it is this one. The oil industry is buzzing. On Thursday, the government approved the development of the biggest deposit discovered in the British territory for at least 10 years. And remember I told you just a minute ago about how these North Sea fields saving our bacon from OPEC oil. Here's what they're talking about with this large find. This the biggest deposit discovered in British territory for at least 10 years. They're all told this is a huge find, dispels the idea the North Sea oil is in terminal decline. But then it says, goes on the article, so you begin to recognize how serious the human predicament has become when you discover that this huge new field will supply the world with oil for 5.25 days. So again, this is one of the largest finds in the North Sea fields in a decade, and it'll supply the world of 5.25 days. And I think I brought that up last time we were together, but now you can begin to see how serious this is becoming.
Hold that thought right there for just one moment, Michael. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Michael Trudeau. And Michael was talking about an article he had read recently that talked about this great oil find in Great Britain. And it was the biggest oil find they'd found there in years. And they were going to develop this oil find in Great Britain. But the amount of oil that is anticipated to be there was enough to supply the world for about 5 days or so. You have to realize that the Earth consumes right now about 80 billion barrels of oil every day, of which, of course, we are taking almost a quarter of the world's oil supply. Europe is taking 16.8%. China is taking about 5% of the world's oil supply. But, of course, their demand for oil is insatiable. They have to have oil to fuel everything. They're growing number of cars. They're growing industries. And China's got all throughout the world picking up oil. They're in Saudi Arabia. They're actually putting in oil fields in Saudi Arabia. They're in Africa. They are certainly making deals with Iran and other countries in the Middle East. They're even up in Canada developing the oil sale there. They're in Venezuela getting oil that ordinarily would be coming to the United States. There is going to be a real competition for oil between the United States and China. No question at all. China's developed the oil fields in Sudan. She has to have oil. She has to have more and more oil. And, of course, there begins to get a shortage of oil, then what happens? Does the world economy collapse? Do we go to war for oil, as the Japanese did in the Second World War? We live in a very uncertain world, and right now, of course, oil seems to be a key to that.
Yeah, and you know, you've hit the nail again on the head. You're just hitting them out of the park tonight, Stan. This one is again the same key. You mentioned, you know, what will happen when we begin to get tighter and tighter for this oil. What will China do? Will we have an economic collapse? Will there be wars? Yes, just not in that order. I think we've already begun to see the wars develop. We're over in Iraq right now, pretty much parking up home base for saying, hey, we want to make sure we've got a pal here or a personal presence in the fields and be right next door to our neighbors in Saudi Arabia and Iran here, and hopefully things will go our way. It doesn't look like it is, but hopefully it will, because, again, you've got this issue with China. These guys have become the world's second greatest consumer of oil as of last year, surpassing Japan. And this industrial machine that the Chinese have growing is consuming and gobbling up this oil at an ever-increasing pace. These guys are actually outbidding us for the oil. So what will it come down to? Well, it may just come down to those wars. Either way, though, it's going to come down to economic collapse. There's no way around that. You won't be able to... There's no way that you can currently take American or industrialized nations' way of life and say, well, we're just going to switch over to this system now and change everything about the way we're doing, but it will be seamless. Now, it's just going to be one of those things where it gets progressively worse and progressively worse and progressively worse.
Well, I think what's really so interesting is the realization that our industrial capacity here, our standard of living, is based upon the availability of energy. Well, you know, of course, we can create electricity by burning coal, but that pollutes the environment, and there's the Kyoto Protocol, and if we ever were to sign that, we certainly couldn't produce electricity from coal. We're told we're running out of natural gas. Now, whether we are or whether or not, we're told that, and certainly there's no way we're allowed to develop natural gas because of all the environmental laws in this country, and certainly that applies, of course, to the North Slope of Alaska, where I happen to believe there's plenty of natural gas. We're not going to be allowed to develop that. So if we can't develop electricity from coal, and we're really running out of natural gas, or we're going to be restricted as far as production, we certainly can't create electricity from oil. We're tearing down dams in America today, which have been provided hydroelectric power for 50 or more years. We're tearing those dams down. Every effort has been made to discourage the development of nuclear energy in this country, although, of course, other countries are... France gets 80% of their electricity from nuclear, but we can't figure out what to do with the fuel rods here and the spent electricity. Nobody ever asked what they do with France, in France or in Japan. Be that as it may, if we don't have abundant, cheap electricity, the American way of life as we know it will cease to exist.
It will definitely change. There's no question about it. And it will be a change for the worse, and it will be a change in dramatic fashion. You know, I used to think, and I can remember when that Y2K issue was coming, and they were talking about, boy, this could really wipe out the infrastructure and bring the transportation system down. And, you know, back in the back of the farthest recesses of my mind, I thought, boy, wouldn't that kind of be neat? You know, everybody kind of reduced to being on the same playing field for a while. You know, the big guys, everybody kind of gets a fair shake. They give it a go now. And what I mean by that is literally the whole central banking cartel comes crashing down, and, you know, they're on the same playing field as all the rest of us. And I thought, nah, absolute fantasy. That part isn't going to happen.
You're absolutely right.
This one, however, I think is going to happen. And I don't think there's any way we can get around this one, period. Everything that I've read, all the research I've done on this situation, or this issue with peak oil over the last couple of years, has pointed to the fact that it's absolutely for real, and we're in big trouble.
Well, we'll have to do a program on that some evening when I have all of my research done. But it doesn't matter whether it's for real or whether it's contrived. It's going to have a profound impact on our way of life and on the way of life of everybody listening to this program. Because, of course, the $70 a barrel, about $70 a barrel for oil, or I think it was $65 today, something like that. But, you know, I believe it's going to go up probably to $100 or maybe even much higher. But even at $70 a barrel, it's going to have a profound impact on our lives, because people are not going to have the money to spend. And this is what people have to understand. Right now, we are a consumer economy, but what happens when the people don't have that money? Because it's going to buy gasoline. It's going to buy, to pay for the diesel fuel that brings us all the products we buy in the grocery store and all of the other things you were talking about, the fertilizer and all of these things. As the price of fertilizer goes up, so does the price of food we buy.
Right, and you know, if you started to look at it like that, and you just simply said, well, let's assume for a minute that oil did stop at $70 per barrel, and that was all it did. And it was not going to go any higher than $70 a barrel. The amount of time it would take for us to economically adjust to $70 a barrel oil, considering that our dollar decline is occurring annually at 12%, you really rapidly realize that that alone would spell catastrophe for the economic situation 1-2 years further out, no matter what. Now, throw in this peak oil issue, the fact that it's not going to stay at 70. As you point out, you believe it would go to 100. Why stop? I mean, what would be there when you ask yourself this question, why is it rising to $70 a barrel right now from what would be last year at this time about $45 a barrel? Why is it at $70 a barrel? If it goes to 100, why would it stop? Is there some reason that it would stop at 100? We've hit the new price for oil. I don't see that part happening. It's rising because it cannot be produced at the level that we are consuming it globally. And, of course, it's simply a supply and demand issue. And when we see a high demand and a low supply, we always see the price reflected on anything. And here we have the situation now developing when we're talking about the global oil. So everybody's fighting for this stuff, and you've got this tremendous problem with supply because the supply is dropping. You can't pull it out of the ground as fast as you used to be able to do. It takes more time and more money to get out of the ground, and what you're pulling out of the ground isn't as high quality either. So again, progressively this situation is worsening, and there's no reason for anybody to believe that this will stop at any time from getting worse than it is today.
Well, I think that the major and most important thing is for people to start realizing how they're going to be able to preserve what they have in times like this. And do you want to go ahead and tell people your telephone number and, of course, how they can get in touch with you there at Colonial Resources? They'd like information about what's happening as far as the oil prices and its impact on our economy.
Sure. One of the things we would do is this. For anybody that's interested on a free report that we've put together on the peak oil situation, because we feel that this is absolutely a dire situation, and we're willing to pass this report out free to anybody who wants it, we ask that you simply pass it around after you've read the copy, hand it out to other people, so that people realize that this is happening, and it's a big one. So again, it's a free report on peak oil. We'll certainly include information on how to protect yourself from this situation financially as far as from the fallout. And you can simply call a toll-free number and just say, hey, I want the free report on peak oil. We'll send one right out to you. The number is 1-800-685-4042. Again, it's 1-800-685-4042. And Dr. Stan, you'd asked, you know, how people could protect themselves from this, and I think that the advice that I can give right now for people is to get into gold now, because this is not a short-term trend that we're seeing. And it's being reflected, of course. Certainly, I've got the perfect barometer because I can watch the gold market, and I do it every day with my business. And so what I'm watching, of course, is, you know, the amount of volume of people that are stepping into the gold market shows me that the general public is really beginning to get panicked here, and they're starting to look to that safe haven of gold, and that's why we're seeing this run-up that's currently happening. And again, just looking at some of the statistics, in about the last 30 days, what would roughly be, well, let's say about a year ago, roughly about a year's time, we've seen gold now increase by about 12 to 13%. In the last 30 days, it's up about 3%. In the last 5 years, it's up about 70%. So again, this is not some type of a short-term trend we're talking about when we see people moving in like this. This is pretty serious. And in addition to that, of course, driving this problem with this inflationary trend is the fact that there's actually a shortage beginning to develop in gold. You're starting to see that basically South Africa, for instance, has had a problem with gold production. They produced only 342 tons last year, which is an amount not recorded since 1931. They're also saying that this year they're going to produce less than 300 tons. So that, of course, again, supply-demand issue. You've got that supply becoming a problem. Demand is certainly ratcheting up in great demand. You can see it in Asia right now dramatically. So again, this is something that I think is no short-term trend. I think this is the long-term new horizon that we're looking at for both economics, oil, and I might even throw in the fact that I think gold, as far as being below 450, is a thing of the past.
Well, you know, I think it's very interesting, the attitude of the people in the Orient and in India compared with the attitude of people here in America. I mean, the Americans have lived very comfortably with the fiat money system, going back, of course, to 1913, but certainly much more so since the Richard Nixon took the United States and really the world off the gold standard back in 1971. But, you know, so we profited from this. I mean, my goodness, our government could simply print money and send it throughout the world and export our inflation to other countries. And of course, with the low prices on products we get from China, why we're not feeling the ravages of inflation, we're living at the highest living standard any country ever has. But the people in China, the people in Asia, certainly the people in India, value things much more than the people in America, where everything comes free, and if we don't have it, why, the government's going to provide for us, and they're going to provide for our health and for our education and for our welfare. But the people in China are looking after themselves, and my understanding is that over in China, in Japan, and India, people are beginning individually to collect both gold and silver because they want something of inherent value. They don't necessarily trust a paper money system any more than Alan Greenspan does.
Yeah, well, they certainly are showing that they don't trust ours. I mean, China disconnected itself from the dollar like no problem, and you start to wonder yourself, you know, what's going to happen when some of these oil-producing nations follow suit and say, yeah, I love you guys, and I want to be your ally, but at the same time, I can't let my own economy die. So like China, I'm going to have to disconnect, and there goes Saudi Arabia. And there go, you know, I mean, it just, this is something that's just beginning to show itself as these countries are starting to say, yeah, I'm a little bit nervous about hanging with the U.S. dollar anymore. And why shouldn't they be? I can't believe they've propped us up this long, as far as I'm concerned. Obviously, you've got some string pulling and manipulation going on behind the scenes. But the problem with it is, hey, you can only prop something up or pull those strings for so long before everybody finally says, look, I can see that the emperor has no clothes. I'm out of here.
Well, there is talk, and certainly I think it's more than just talk, that Saudi Arabia is thinking of perhaps going to the euro, or at least maybe to a basket of currencies as the basis for the evaluation of their currency. And of course, that's, they would be then selling oil not based upon the dollar, but based upon a basket of currencies. And Iran seems to be going that same direction. Of course, you remember when Saddam Hussein actually was going to start selling his oil in euros rather than dollars. Why, it was very, very soon after that that we were at war with Iraq. Was that the major reason? I think it was probably one of the reasons, although I think the war was planned long before the September 11th attack. But I think that what Saddam had done would certainly endanger the stability of the American dollar. And if Iran were to start selling her oil based upon the euro or a basket of currencies, as Saudi Arabia is thinking, suddenly America's predominance, America's reserve currency, would begin to fail, and that would have profound impact on our way of life, because all of those billions and billions of dollars that are held by foreign central banks could well begin to come cascading back in here with tremendous inflationary pressures being put on our people.
And remember, you know, not only was the euro created to compete with the dollar, but now suddenly you've got the Chinese yuan, which people are kind of saying, hey, you know, China's really kind of kicking it into high gear here. They look like a pretty interesting country to go invest in, and now they're disconnected from the dollar and the yuan can move. I might look at that now. So again, you've got a new currency, kind of, if you will, on the playing field that says, hey, come and take a look at me for your investment. Because, again, just about anything out there is going to do better than the United States dollar at this point in time. You invest in anything outside of the dollar, anything besides the dollar, and you will probably end up looking well, at least on paper.
Well, I guess this evening has been Michael Trudeau from Colonial Resources, and Michael does help keep Radio Liberty on the air. Michael, would you want to go ahead and give your telephone number and your website out just one more time?
Sure, be happy to. Folks can call us, and again, they can ask for the free report on peak oil, and we'll certainly include the information on how to protect yourself financially from the fallout. All you have to do is call us toll-free. The number is 1-800-685-4000. And a lot of the articles that we've talked about tonight and a lot of the material that I gain, I have posted up on the website at colonialresources.com. Feel free to take those and download those at your pleasure.
And I think it's so important that people begin to realize that we're going to have to individually be responsible for ourselves and start making our plans accordingly. History is certainly plagued by the story over and over again, where when people put confidence in government currency, And, of course, it let them down. In fact, Aristotle is quoted, and the quotation comes from John Bartlett's Familiar Quotations. Aristotle is quoted as saying, there's absolutely nothing wrong with fiat money, as long as you have perfect authority and godlike wisdom in kings. And until people understand that there's nothing new under the sun, what's going on in America with this idea that the government can create wealth simply by printing it, has failed over and over again. It failed in ancient Greece. It failed in ancient Rome. It failed time and time again throughout the centuries. It failed in France in the early 1700s, in the United States, as we went through the Revolutionary War, and in France again in 1789, and in Germany, and, well, we saw this in Argentina just a short while ago. We saw it in Russia. We saw it in Russia in the early 1990s when they wiped out the savings of these poor people who lived under communist yoke for so long, and all they'd managed to put away for their old age was wiped out in a matter of just a few weeks. We'll be back in just a moment to wrap up the program here with Michael Trudeau. Well, Michael, we've got about 3 minutes to go. Somebody had called in and asked about silver. What do you think about silver as an investment?
You know, here's the thing I think about silver. There's twofold on it. One is that it's an industrial metal, not a monetary metal. So you are looking at it as far as a valuation protector. I want to protect the value of my money. It may not do that for you. And a good example is a year ago, August, it was $805 an ounce. Today it closed at $698. So you're seeing a pretty rapid decline in silver, while gold in the same period is up about 10-12%. So that's one aspect. The other thing is, for people who would say, I want to have it as a economic insurance policy so I can barter with it. Well, here I've always said to people, look, a bag of silver costs you about $5,000 or so, weighs 55 pounds. If it gets that bad out there that we're trading gold and silver for food, I have to assume we're under martial law or there's anarchy in the streets. Would you want to be in a position where you've got a 55-pound backpack? Well, now I've got that exact example, because as you watch that fallout from Katrina and these people fleeing, can you imagine these people with a 55-pound bag of silver hidden in a backpack at the Superdome, you know, with what was going on down there? I'd rather have that $5,000 in the form of, you know, 20 small gold coins I can fit in my left pants pocket that nobody knows I've got, and I'm still getting out with my value. And you could walk out with $100,000 worth of gold coins on you and pretty much have it hidden in ways that nobody could even see it.
All right. So I think that then would be your answer to the caller as far as silver. And certainly these are difficult times we live in. I never thought I would see the time when we would have probably a 500,000 refugees who are Americans who are living in our own country. That is the most incredible thing I've ever seen.
It is something that's just staggering to me when you see this, because I can't even fathom this. And one of the things I talked about when I mentioned that to my mom is, I said, you know, here we are almost a week into this thing, and these people don't even know where they're going yet. If this had been some foreign country that we had come to the aid of because they had gone through something like this, by now it seems we would have tent cities erected with beautiful beds and staffed with medical people, and there'd be food and water everywhere, and everybody'd be fine and protected in some major tent city. And still here we are now 2 weeks past this thing, and people are wandering around on buses from city to city trying to figure out what to do next. It seems to me that this is really an interesting breakdown of what we thought we would be prepared for. And again, Chris, it's shocking.
And what's really so shocking is they're giving everybody a card for $2,000. And what happens when that $2,000 debit card is gone? And where does the federal government get the right to take money from you and I to give to refugees? Many of us give independently because we have human compassion.
Right, and I read an article that said, you know, most of these people aren't taking these debit cards and going down to buy food. They're going down to buy $800 Louis Vuitton purses.
Well, we're just about out of time. Michael, God bless you. Thank you so very much for being with us. We'll look forward to having you later.
God bless you as well, Stan.
Bye-bye. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we're really largely dependent on those of you who listen to our programs to help us as we reach out across America 5 hours every weekday and then on our weekends to try to educate people as to what's really going on. Now, if you believe, as I do, that we're involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political and ideological and cultural and economic and educational battlefield, we do hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family. If you'd like to know more about our ministry, why call us at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. You can listen to our programs 5 hours a day on the Internet at RadioLiberty.com. That's www.RadioLiberty.com, either directly or indirectly. 3 hours on Radio Liberty and 2 hours on other networks you're on. And then after you've completed that, if you want more information, you can go to our archives, and we keep the Radio Liberty programs archived there for some time. So we hope, of course, that you will listen to our programs, understand what's really going on behind the scenes. There really is an invisible government that works behind the scenes. We call them the cult hierarchy because that's what they call themselves. Well, how can we say that? Well, you can go up into Google and you Google in a cult hierarchy. And after you've read my newsletters, they're there. And then, of course, you go to the websites that are put up by people who are part of the cult hierarchy. There really are people who are either knowingly or unknowingly controlled by the other dimension. Lots of people are intrigued by these programs on television, Ghost Whispers, Medium, about these people who are in contact with the other dimension. What makes you think that people who lead our government, making our financial policies, are also not in contact with the other dimension? Well, they really are. If you'd like a free copy of my newsletter on the occult hierarchy, I would ask for the occult hierarchy part 2. Why, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And we'll be glad to send you a free copy of that newsletter. And we want you to challenge everything in it. We want you to read the books written by people who are working with the occult hierarchy. The people who they say recruited them into the occult hierarchy. This one book we talk about called Extraordinary. Time's Extraordinary Beings names the most wealthy man in the United States as having recruited him to this whole incredible movement. And then he talks about the former dictator of the Soviet Union as being part and parcel of this occult hierarchy group. And of course, this is written by a man who lives over in Henderson, Nevada, who went there along with people from all across the world, waiting for the return of this being from the other dimension. Incredible. Well, you have to read what he has to say and decide if it really could be true. We are involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men and for the survival of Western civilization. And the problem is that most people don't even know there's a problem. So please go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. If you'd like to get a free newsletter, why, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Please pray for America, pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. Once to every man and nation comes that time they must decide, in that strife of truth with falsehood, for the good or for the evil side. Then it is the brave man chooses, while the coward stands aside, until the multitudes make virtue of the faith they have denied. Though the cause of evil prospers, yet his truth alone is strong, though a portion be the scaffold and upon the throne be wrong. But that scaffold sways the future, for in the dim unknown standeth God within the shadows, keeping watch above his own. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls until we ask for them, because we have with us, hopefully on the line very soon, Patrick Wood. And Patrick Wood publishes a monthly newsletter. But, you know, I was attracted to and encouraged to have him on the line after reading the article he had written that was published in newswithviews.com on the global city. And of course, you have to understand, there really are elitists out there. There really is an elite group that works through the Council on Foreign Relations, the Bilderbergers, and they have literally dozens of front groups in America, the Foreign Policy Association, the ACLU, the ADL, so many organizations really have always served as fronts for this power elite. They have meetings. They work through the great tax-exempt foundations, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Carnegie Foundation, and dozens of other foundations. And I've been to their headquarters at 5868th Street in New York City. That's the headquarters of the Council on Foreign Relations. And you have to, of course, sign in when you go in. You have to have permission to go in, but I was able to get in. And, you know, you sign in, and, of course, I would sign in, and there'd be people from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and all of these people who work with these think tanks and foundations. They're planning our world, because, you see, these people have a different worldview. They're an elitist group. They are the ruling aristocracy that make mockery of the idea that we elect our representatives. Oh, we elect our representatives, but they pick our representatives. And when we go to the polls, we vote for not the candidate of our choice, but for the candidate of their choice. And this has happened over and over again. I cover that in a four-tape set called Secret Societies, where we simply follow all the elections in the United States from 1936 on, when, of course, they picked Alf Landon to run against Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And then in 1940, they picked Wendell Willkie, who was a lifelong Democrat, who suddenly re-registered Republican a few months before the convention in 1940, and then ran against the Democrat presidency as a Republican. In other words, he was a lifelong Democrat who suddenly registered as a Republican and was picked to run against the FDR. It was all a sham, as most of our elections are. Our last election, two members of the same secret society, Skull and Bones at Yale, running against one another, criticizing one another, sort of like Abbott and Costello, or Martin and Lewis, or Amos and Andy. Oh, it's a game. But, you know, until people understand that it is a game, it is put on, it's all show business, why we will continue going along with this. Well, Patrick Wood has actually written a fascinating story about the global city. And this is their dream. How they will manipulate and control us and use, of course, force people into the urban environment where they can be watched and monitored and controlled. And Patrick, thank you so very much for being with us this evening.
Good evening. It's a pleasure to be here, Dr. Stan.
And, of course, you've actually been reading their material on the global city, haven't you?
Well, I have for quite some time, actually, and that's not the only subject that my study is limited to. Oh. But it's something new on the horizon that I had not really seen before.
Hold that thought right there. We're going to just bring on our stations, and then we'll be right back with Patrick Wood talking about the global city. We'll pick up the story there, Patrick.
Sure.
Go ahead.
Okay, great. The concept of global city has been written about so far only in think tanks like the Brookings Institution, the Rand Institute, Rand Corporation, and so on. It's kind of a new topic to the area of globalism, but it's a fascinating one. I chose to write about it recently because I really didn't find any other critical analysis of this concept. And so that's what sparked your contacting me in the first place to discuss this. It's kind of a new thing. It very much is in line with the standard globalist PAP that we've all been dealing with for a long time. The global corporation, the move towards global governance, the United Nations involvement in regional governments, and so on.
And of course, we see this manifest through the United Nations, and then the idea of a global army and a global police force and a global court, really, of course, global taxation. Everything, of course, is to do away with national sovereignty, and these people working in government or working within the tax-exempt foundations of the think tanks have no loyalty to America. Of course, they will mouth these ideas, oh, we're great patriots and we love God, but they worship a different God. They have a different agenda. And, of course, the one thing is the destruction of America's sovereignty, and until people understand that, you can't understand why both George Bush and John Kerry supported globalization, and this was never brought up as an issue during the election. Why? Why? Because both political parties support exactly the same program, and it doesn't matter that the American people don't want it. They have an agenda, they have the power, they control the media, and they're going to implement it unless we can educate the people. So pick it up from there, Patrick.
That's exactly right. I was came into possession today of the transcript that I received from Dr. David Abbott, who spoke recently at the Freedom 21 conference in Reno. He's from Great Britain. And he's one of the few people in Great Britain that understands how the European Union has taken away the rights of the people. And I found it very instructive that he said that we're, 10-plus years behind their development of the global into the global community of the European Union. And he pointed out that in the beginning they were, promised that sovereignty would not be lost because they entered the common market, but then as soon as they did, it triggered a whole chain of events. They found themselves all of a sudden in the European economic community. Then they found
hold that thought for just a minute as we bring our other stations on board.
Sure. Well,
this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Patrick Wood. And Patrick is an author. I've read his articles, and he actually publishes a magazine. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later. But he is just saying that he had come upon some material that was given at the recent Freedom 21 conference in Reno by an Englishman who was saying that the United States is 10 years behind what's going on in England. The people of Europe were promised that if they entered the European common market, it would not interfere with sovereignty. And what you must understand is the people, the aristocracy, has to lie to the people because they have their agenda. They don't want the people to know what the plan is. And, of course, once the countries had gone into the European Union, of course it was going to do away with their sovereignty. There were all sorts of international laws that superseded sovereignty. And, of course, this went along then with creating the European currency and then the European Parliament. It doesn't matter that France and the Netherlands have voted against it. The elite have their objectives. And they're going to impose it upon us serfs, because this is basically the old idea, the feudal lords, the people of great wealth and great money, then imposing their will on the serfs, and you and I are serfs. And until the people of America and Europe understand that there really is this global aristocracy, and their dedication is not to the individual country that, of course, many times they have sworn oaths to uphold, but to this global dream, to the new world order and the new world religion. Until people understand that these people lie and deceive and cheat, yes, and will murder and create wars and all sorts of terrible things, because their goal certainly supersedes any concept of integrity. Integrity, of course, is for the common people, the aristocracy above honesty. So pick up the story, Patrick.
Well, exactly. The end of that story that was told by Dr. David Abbott was that 80% of all the laws in Great Britain right now are being determined by entities outside of their country. And this is shocking to think that they were boiled incrementally like the frog, you know, not knowing that the temperature was rising, and now all of a sudden it's too late for them to do much about it. We may still have some time to do something about it in the United States. We hope so. When we started our research 25, 30 years ago, I was collaborating with Anthony Sutton, who formerly had been with the Hoover Institution for War, Peace, and Revolution at Stanford. His writings were so controversial that it got him frozen out of Stanford, unfortunately, and we met when he was kind of on the rebound. He couldn't get work at any other scholarly organization at the time either.
Well, of course, any scholar who tells the truth, will, of course, they come under tremendous pressure. And I, of course, actually, Anthony Sutton told me what had happened. He had actually gone to the Republican convention in 1972 and told the members of a special committee there the United States was funding the North Vietnamese by funding the Soviets, and then, of course, the Soviets were funding the North Vietnamese, and all of the technology that was used to create the weapons of war that were killing our boys was coming from the United States, along with the massive loans, the building of the truck plant at the Kama River, and the Fiat plant, all done with American money. All of this built in Russia to build up their economy so they could support the North Vietnamese. And when Professor Sutton got back to the Hoover Institute, where he was a scholar, why his name was gone off the door. His telephone was disconnected. That's what happens to people who tell the truth at conservative think tanks like the Hoover Institute.
That's exactly what happened to him. We teamed up in 1976 and began to target the Trilateral Commission, which we were actually the first critical study of the Trilateral Commission 3 years after it had been formed in 1973. We nailed down definitively the trilateral plans for a new economic world order and some of the other things that were just taking place right then. 25 years later, we find ourselves, like not flying a Piper Cub anymore. We're flying a Boeing 747 with globalism. Their plans have matured. They've branched out. They've thrown untold millions of dollars in studies and stuff to support their rationale for doing these things. And so 25 years later, we look at this, and it's just smeared all over the face of the planet. It's just absolutely amazing. So even though Dr. Sutton passed away a few years ago, I'm intent on bringing back the quality and the amount of research, the type of research that we did back then, to pin the tail on the donkey, so to speak, here correctly. And one of the things that has come up, this issue of global city, is absolutely fascinating. It's an extension of, I'm sure, of the concept of regional government, where the national governments would give up sovereignty to the greater organizational body. In Europe, that happened to be the European Union. In the Americas, it's likely going to be something like the Organization of American States, which will provide some government functions over Canada, United States, Mexico, and the Central American, perhaps South American countries as well. But for the global city, the problem that brings all this up is that corporations are having a big struggle in dealing with their global operations. You can imagine now somebody like an IBM or a Hewlett-Packard, they have plants in 35, 40 countries. They have all kinds of accounting practices going on, all kind of laws they need to observe, and so on. They have real obvious logistical issues that's very difficult for them to face and to deal with. And the concept of the global city is to pluck certain cities out of the infrastructure, out of the nationalistic infrastructure around the world, and essentially remove them from the constraints of that nation state, the legal structure, the cultural structure, and so on, and create a new class of cities, a new type of entity that needs to be governed. It really isn't part of the nation state, but it's kind of a superset, if you will, of cities where these companies can go and find the same kind of services in each city, no matter where they go to. It's kind of like going to Embassy Suites Hotel when you're traveling. If you go to one in San Jose, it's the same as you go to one in New York. You know exactly what to expect when you go there. They even say the same things when you walk in the door. The global city concept is kind of like that, to provide the services to these global corporations that they need on a consistent basis worldwide, but that they cannot provide themselves directly. And when you have a workforce, as in the case of IBM, that numbers in the hundreds of thousands of people, they have employees that don't speak each other's language, even from India, from South Africa, from China. They need a way to integrate their operations, and the global city is what's being offered right now as a solution to it. It's also worthy to note that whenever you see studies like this come out, that there's three phases that happens when things get rolling. First is the idea is floated, and that's the presentation of the idea. Secondly, you have the acceptance phase where everybody kind of gets consensus, buys into it, and they float it to the public and whatever. And then you have the implementation phase. We're certainly just moving out of the presentation phase and into the acceptance phase right now, and that's why I believe these papers and ideas are being floated in global magazines like the Brown Journal of World Affairs and the Foreign Affairs magazine, the mouthpiece of the CFR, and so on. So we're in the acceptance phase right now. That means that implementation is short behind. It's coming soon. It's going to make some radical changes around the world as well.
And of course, you mentioned what the global cities are. There's cities like New York and like Los Angeles, but New York seems to be the premier city for this whole globalist concept. Would that be a fair statement?
It is. And what makes a global city a global city? I should point out that the term doesn't mean world class city. It doesn't mean a big city. It doesn't mean a place you go when you're a tourist. You know, well, I got to go to Paris because that's a world class city. This has a totally different meaning the way these people are using it. A global city is one that's connected by the information network, by internet, by private lines, by the banking community. It's important that these centers have headquarters, if not major regional branches, of the big banking institutions, of the big legal firms, the big accounting firms, the big supply chain management firms. They all need to be present in these global cities, and they all need to be interconnected by the internet and by private communications links. And that's the concept of the global city, one that's connected to these other cities so that workers can work as if they're working next door in the same building.
And I think it's what people have to understand is that these people work through the banking. International banking is part of this. International corporations, most of them are part of it, but not everybody is in them, understand what it's about, but certainly the people in key positions know what it's about. It goes into the foundations, the think tanks. It, of course, controls government. It works through the Council on Foreign Relations, the Club of Rome, and the Bilderbergers, and the Trilateral Commissions, and the hierarchy of these cult organizations we so often talk about here. But they all work together. Sometimes they work in competition, but they will have their meetings regularly. The central bankers of the world get together and plot how they're going to control the various governments. And then, of course, we see the corporations, of course, joining together into great cartels. But the government's never going to do anything about it because, of course, they control the governments of this world. We have in Washington, D.C. today some of the finest politicians and bureaucrats that money can buy, which, of course, is why we're in the problems we are today. But the global city is really a means of coordinating this within nations. And here, of course, the corporations can work and combine their whole, electronically, their whole global workforce, hundreds of thousands of people, all working together for the common good of the great corporation, the great corporations that rule the world.
Exactly.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Patrick Wood. He's talking about the global city. I'd make one more comment and then let him pick up the story. But there is a book. It was written in the 1880s by a man named Edward Bellamy. And Edward Bellamy's book was called Looking Backward. And it was the story of a man who fell asleep, and when he woke up, and it was in the year 2000, why, of course, it was sort of Rip Van Winkle's sort of story, but this was this wonderful new utopian world that they had dreamed of. In fact, he even there quotes from that wonderful poem that is known to all those who are part and parcel of the secret movement at Locksley Hall. You know, and I looked into the future as far as any eye could see, saw a vision of the world and all the wonder there would be, and the heavens filled with shouting and the rain to ghastly doom. Of the nation's airy navies grappling in the central blue till the war drums throbbed no longer and the battle flags were furled in the Parliament of Man, the Federation of the World. And then he talked about everything was controlled by the great corporations, because all the corporations had begun to unite until finally there was just one great corporation, there was one with government, and everybody was provided for from the cradle to the grave. That is their dream, this ruling elite who today rule the world. So pick up the story there, Patrick.
Well, I mean, now that you mentioned Rip Van Winkle, I feel a little bit like him myself, because as I was away from research and writing for a little over 20 years, as I came back and studied the whole scene again, looking back to our original writings and research in the 70s and 80s, it's like, man, a lot has happened. Everything has changed, but everything's the same.
Well, in fact, the wonderful book that was written in those days by Professor Sutton, who you were so close to, Trilateralists Over Washington. It's available through my ministry. It's a wonderful book, The Trilateralist Domination of the Government of the United States during the 1970s, specifically during the Carter administration.
Yes, and unfortunately they're still at it. Nothing has really changed there for sure. The amount of people involved in globalism now and the move towards globalism, of course, is multiplied by several orders of magnitude. Back then, you had a relatively small core or cadre of people who were really pushing these globalist ideas. They're truly a minority, just a small number of people. Today, you have universities all over the world kicking out complete generations of global-minded citizens, if you will, that are the new business managers running into the corporate world and so on. And you know, now it's multiplying like rabbits. It's everywhere. It just seems to be more pervasive than it ever was before. It's an express train for sure. The global city concept, there's some really interesting and very paternalistic quotations I'd probably like to throw out here to your listeners and just let them get an idea of what what their attitude towards us is. The global city is being described as a new strategic, they call it a new strategic transnational space. This anchored in these global cities, and that and they talk in terms of forming new claims on that space. In other words, a global city. They say that I'm just quoting from one.
Why don't you hold that, because we're going to bring our stations back on. I really want our listeners to hear what you have to say so they can put this all into context. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan and our guest this evening, Patrick Wood. And Patrick was talking, just giving us a quotation from their writings about what they're referring to as the global city. It's a transnational space, Could you explain what they're talking about and then go ahead and give your quotation?
Well, yes. What they're talking about is the concept of the global city needs to be removed from the nation state so that it can be managed by this, you know, by some greater organization for the good of the corporate global world that they're trying to achieve. They call this process denationalizing, and they're going to seek to denationalize what they call the urban space, that's the city, and they talk about formation of new claims by these what they call transnational actors. That would be the global corporations in non-governmental organizations like the UN and others that are trying to get into the global governance business. And it, according to them, quote, it raises the question, and I quote, whose city is it? This is the most pregnant question I ever saw in a recent writing. Whose city is it indeed? If their idea is to denationalize a city and turn it over to the transnational actors that want to use it for their own good, it's like, well, you know, what does this really mean? I think if I was to take off the unpolitically correct suit and just talk in plain lingo, I'm not sure that I wouldn't use a word like hijacking. It's like, you know, here the city belongs to us one day, and the next day it's going to be denationalized and turned over to some other governing body who's going to make the rules and you know, deal with that city instead of, for instance, United States of America. Could it be that New York and Los Angeles, for instance, someday don't belong to the United States anymore?
And as incredible as it may seem, these people have a different world vision. They have no loyalty to America. It is all to this globalist dream, this idea that there should be a ruling elite that rules the world. They don't want individualism. They do not want smart people. They do not want people who are patriotic. In fact, they're doing everything they can to destroy the health of a whole generation of our young people. And we see this, of course, with half of the young men who went off to fought in Gulf War I, half of them are ill. Do you think that happened just by accident? Of course it didn't. They knew exactly what they were doing. They just don't want the American people to know what they're doing to the minds and the hearts and the souls of our young people, of our soldiers who are being sold over to Iraq to be contaminated with depleted uranium. And many of them, of course, will never be the same, not because of their war wounds and not even because of their psychiatric problems, but because, of course, exposure to toxic material that they know is toxic. And they're doing the same thing with our children, with the vaccines. They're doing the same thing with the fluoridation of water. They're doing the same thing with aspartame, which is, of course, put into our food thanks to Donald Rumsfeld in the 1980s when he was president of J.D. Searle and used his political pressure to get a toxic substance that contains methanol into our food. They know exactly what they're doing. But these people want, of course, to actually begin to take over our cities, and they will not be part of America. They will be part of this transnational world that they believe in, this corporate world that really rules the world.
Exactly.
Go ahead.
The other thing that's interesting about this, the whole theory of the city versus the rural world, you know, of course, back 150 years ago, 95% of the people did not live in cities. They lived in farms and in rural settings. Now, it's someday it's going to flip-flop where, you know, we have 80% of all the people living in the cities around the world. The attitude of these people that are writing about the global city towards the rural communities in the world is just distressingly negative. Almost to the point of, you know, like a persecution type of an attitude on the rural communities. And, of course, what's scary here is that it exposes the globalist attitude of disdain towards the rural areas in the world that they, you know, that on one hand they say, well, we need to rid Africa of poverty. Well, Africa is still a rural nation. I mean, all the countries are still primarily rural and agrarian. Yet, on the other hand, take an inside look, these people have total disdain towards the rural communities of the world. It's a real dichotomy, and it's a scary thing to think what they're going to do when they take control of the cities. That's where the votes are, as we know. When they take control of the cities, then where does that leave rural America? I'm afraid it's going to leave them out on a limb.
And of course, then we could carry that over to Africa. I mean, where it's going to happen to Africa with almost a quarter of the people there dying of AIDS. Is that happening by accident? In some parts of Africa, like Botswana, 40% of the women, pregnant women, are HIV positive. That's either the greatest public health failure of all time or the greatest genocidal accomplishment of all time. Could there be anything that horrible that we really want to kill people? Well, read what Jacques Cousteau has said and then understand. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course our guest this evening, Patrick Wood. We're talking about the global city, and I was just commenting that, you know, there really are people who have a different attitude. Patrick was saying that these elitists look with disdain at the people living in rural areas, but even more than that, they look with disdain on the black of Africa. They really do have a genocidal program, and if you doubt that, why you give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And ask for the article out of the UNESCO Courier, November of 1991, by Jacques Cousteau, and we'll send you a copy of that in both either English or French. Ordinarily, we send them out in English, however. Now, they're not talking specifically about targeting the black, but they are talking about targeting the populations. Go ahead, Patrick.
I'd like to just read a short sentence from one of the articles that I studied when I was researching the global city. I won't mention all the authors and stuff, but it's in our newsletter that we're talking about here. It says, quote, residual rural attitudes and institutions are major reasons why cities do not work well for all residents, marginalizing some and excluding others. Transferring into an urban context long-held prejudices and a natural fear of strangers, a fear that is intimately connected to rural settlements, provides the basis for dysfunctional social relationships. Prejudice and fear slow the wheels of both commerce and government. It's a shocking statement that what they believe is holding back their plan here with global cities is basically the rural attitudes that have crept into cities, because of course people from rural communities go to cities and bring their stinking attitudes with them. I say stinking from their point of view. And they talk about having a positive mindset towards the global city, not just the physical thing, physical infrastructure issues, but they say it's also a state of mind, and that it requires a new positive thinking among its inhabitants. The bottom conclusion of this is, what's holding back the positive thinking and the creation of the global city? What they're saying is, it's the evil rural mentality. Well, there's a lot of people in America that still live in the country, I hate to say. And I wouldn't necessarily say that they're evil rural, the evil rural mentality types, but you get a picture of the disdain that they hold for people who don't, just fall into line like good little global citizens and do what they say is best for them.
Hold that thought there for just a moment, Patrick. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, I guess, is Patrick Wood, and of course his publication is AugustReview.com, and we'll tell you in just a moment how to get that. But Patrick was saying the sort of disdain that these elitists have towards the common people, towards the rural people, and you have a completely different worldview on the part of the elite who tie into the global corporations and want this global governance and that of the average American, who has traditional values and believes there's right and wrong and believes in God and family and country, and that is, of course, certainly looked down upon. There's ideas of integrity. They disapprove of that. They have a different worldview because I believe they worship a different God. Before we go on, Patrick, would you like to tell our listeners your website and your telephone number if people would like to get in touch with you and get more information?
Certainly. Our website is www.augustreview.com. That's August like the month. And we do have an 800 number, a toll-free number that people can call if they wish during business hours, of course, at Pacific Standard Time, 800-775-6394. The preferable way to contact...
One more time with that telephone number.
800-775-6394.
All right, fine. And, Kurt, go right ahead then.
Well, I was just going to say the preferable way to contact us is probably just to go to our website initially. You're welcome to call, but we're delivering our content over the Internet almost exclusively at this point. And we felt that's the quickest way to get the information out. So we're making pretty much everything available over the Internet. And people are welcome to go there and check out our website and find out what they need to know to follow on with us.
All right, fine. So, Sidney, I've been to the website. It looks very, very provocative. So, but you were talking about this attitude, this almost superior attitude of these people have, who advocate the global city. And the global city is really more of a state of mind. And yet, of course, they will use these cities to establish these centers for the new global society that they're creating, and their total disdain for people with a rural outlook, to hold the old-fashioned virtues as important. Pick up the story there.
I think if I could speak, if I could kind of put my thinking into their, my feet into their shoes and think like them, just for a second, this is not me saying this, I'm talking for them. The ideal thing that I could do if I wanted to maximize the resources in a country would essentially be to herd all the people from the country into the cities and then brainwash them to make them, compatible, get rid of their evil rural mentality, and replace that with a good citizen city mentality. And then they would be available to be workers in the global society according to their concept of what a worker should be. This rather smacks of some other plans in history that have come and gone and mostly failed. It certainly smacks of some core principles that Marxism and communism has held for many decades, as you know. Re-educate the masses. Concentrate them into areas of density like the cities, and then make them acceptable for the global workforce, so that they can be happy little workers and get their happy little paychecks and then just go home and have their happy little non-families or whatever they're going to do with what's not between man and wife. The end conclusion of this is really Orwellian in nature.
I certainly agree with you. Everything is planned. Everything is watched. You would be monitored, from the cradle to the grave.
It would almost seem that way. I'm not a sociologist. I've done a lot of studies, read a lot of sociological studies over the years, but I'm not a trained sociologist. But I look at this, and you just kind of extrapolate what these people are talking, where their focus is, and it really is. It's so fantastic that people can't hardly believe it when you explain it to them. Even when you show them in their own writings, where they're saying this stuff, the concept is so big that it's almost impossible for somebody to understand it and accept it. That's one reason we're having trouble, as you know, getting people to see this picture. It's just like if they've never seen it before and they see it for the first time, their mind just disconnects. So I can't believe that's true. It's too big.
Protecting these people, these wicked people on the other side, is that people say nothing could be like that. And I refuse to believe it. And the reason they refuse to believe it is their minds are controlled. There's been a conscious effort to control the outlook of the way people think. Our minds are molded, our ideas are formed, our tastes are created largely by men we have never heard of, because they control the media and the educational system, and they constantly barrage us with information that they want us to know, and they ridicule anybody who ever suggests that there might be a plan, a master plan behind what's going on in the world today.
Yes, and I would underscore that I myself when Tony Sutton and I were writing together, we ardently fought the idea of conspiracy. We were not conspiracy theorists, and I am not today. And the reason I'm not is because these people have put it in black and white where anybody with an eyeball and that can read can go and see exactly what they're doing. There's nothing hidden here. It's in broad daylight. But if you don't go and look at what they're writing and what they have said they're going to do and what they have done, you'll never see it. But it's not like it's really being withheld from anybody. It's just that nobody really wants to go out and pick up the low hanging fruit that's out there to expose this stuff. It's sad. It's really sad.
Well, that's
because it's happening right under our nose in broad daylight. It's like a burglar walking into your home at 12 noon. When you're sitting there having lunch, robs your house, walks out, and you just say, "Have a nice day." And say, "I wasn't robbed."
Well, that's what, of course, our job is to get the information out, and I think that's what you're doing such a very good job in doing.
Thank you. Well, we're trying hard. One of the portions of my newsletter, by the way, showed a table of rankings of world cities. I think you probably alluded to that before. It might be interesting to your listeners just to see how they've broken this down. The study looked at all the cities in the United States, the major cities, and by a number of criteria ranked them and sliced and diced them. New York was the highest rated global city in America. Right behind that was Chicago. Right behind that was Los Angeles. Those are the three top. And then from there you drop down into a third category, which they simply call major specialist world cities, and includes San Francisco, Miami, Atlanta, Washington. Below that there's another grouping called minor specialist world cities, includes Boston, Dallas, and Houston. And then beyond that they have secondary regional centers, minor regional global centers. At the very bottom of the list they have unimportant regional global centers. I hate to tell the residents of Baltimore, Phoenix, and Cincinnati that they're in unimportant regional global centers. So, for whatever that means, they're not going to be scoring high anytime soon. I used to be from Phoenix up until about 20 years ago, and I used to think, and I still think, that Phoenix was a pretty connected city, but they not only didn't make the grade, they made an F minus, according to these people.
I think it's important that people really understand that there is a global elite, that these people have a program that is being rapidly implemented, that these people do not believe in national sovereignty, that these people many times work in key positions in government. And, of course, they work through their conferences. They're having one here later this month, the Millennium Summit. It's, of course, 5 years since the Millennium Conference in New York City, and the new conference will be held marking 5 years since they laid out their master plan for the elitists to take control of government, and almost everything going on today is what they planned at that time. And people don't even know what they planned at that time. Which simply reflects the degree of control that exists today over what the American people think.
Mm-hmm. We've had some people, some of our subscribers, have read our original book, Trilaterals Over Washington. We had two volumes of that book, and they're both on our website in electronic form. We've had some new people read Trilaterals Over Washington that didn't read it back then. It was a bestseller for a period of time back then, by the way. But it's been out of print for a number of years, and so some newbies have read Trilaterals Over Washington, and have made the comment to us it stood their hair on end, because what we predicted from their own writings back then, that is of think tanks, so like the Trilateral Commission and like the Brookings Institution, and others that were feeding them with these ideas, exactly what they said was going to happen has happened in the last 25 years. To the letter. It hasn't, they set out the game plan, they told us what they're going to do, they did it. Now they have, looking backwards, they told us what they've done. And every 5 years, it's like there's another rush of more plans that comes out, like now here's what we're going to do this time. Now here's what we're going to do this, here's what we're going to do now. Here's what we're going to do. And you see waves of studies coming out, like this global city nonsense. And about every 5 years, you have a cycle of this. And if you look backwards, if you go down the road 20 years and let it take place, you look backwards at what they said they were going to do versus what they did, is absolutely hair-raising.
In fact, really was so interesting, somebody called my attention just the other day, that Zygmunt Brzezinski, in his book Between Two Ages, back in 1973, was talking how they were going to be able to control the weather and create weather and all sorts of weather changes, and I'm assuming without them would be hurricanes, and how that could be used, of course, to disrupt societies. And here we are now, 25, 27 years later, really more than that, 32 years later, and we see gigantic hurricanes, of striking and doing immeasurable harm. Can they actually create weather? Of course they could. They knew how to do it back at that time, back in 1973. And the fact that the American people don't know that simply reflects the fact that the elitists are able to control our access to information.
Exactly, and they have done that very well for many years, and they've done that by by the memberships of the board of directors of the major media outlets in America, heavily staffed, these director conferences, heavily staffed by members of the Trial Audit Commission, by members of the CFR, and so on. And they allow out what essentially what they want, or I should say, may turn that around. They suppress what they don't want out. Mm-hmm. It really doesn't matter what does get out, as long as it's what they don't want out. So that's why the talking heads can rattle on about the same thing for hours. It doesn't matter what you talk about; it can be any amount of nonsense you want, as long as the good stuff doesn't get out. You know, they don't really care what gets out, I don't think.
Well, our telephone number, if anybody would like to give us a call, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And no, I didn't realize that you had actually helped Professor Sutton write that Trilateralist over Washington. We do actually, you have it on your website. We actually have it. We still carry that. We think it's a very, very important book.
Excellent.
And people have to understand that everything that's going on is long-range planning. They've known all along exactly what they were going to do.
Yep.
Because they have a different worldview. And they control the wealth. And they control the media. And they control, certainly, the government and the military and the great tax-exempt foundations. And let's go to Jack, who's calling from Michigan. Hi, Jack. Did you have a question for our guest?
Yes, actually, two. Is there any evidence that the elitists declared they would infiltrate the media with their operatives, such as the CIA? Is there any evidence that they indicated that they would eliminate government leaders such as John F. Kennedy if they didn't follow their hidden agenda?
All right, question number one, is there any evidence that they have infiltrated the media with the CIA and CIA operatives?
There's all kinds of... there's all kinds of theories and you know, conspiracy type theories that have been written about this possibility. The only reason that we don't delve heavily into that, honestly, is that there's so much low hanging fruit that, you know, where we can prove a connection, that we don't really go beyond what we can't get first hand research on. My guess is that the media in general is full of all kinds of unsavory characters that are not there just for professional journalistic endeavors. Can we prove that on a case by case basis? Maybe sometimes you can. We see the effects of stuff from time to time where we know there was something going on that was kind of screwball. We can look at the media. We can look at the directors, the board of directors of any of the major media in the world today. We can see the makeup of those boards of directors. And when we have a solid tie between the global elite and the directorship of a media outlet, we know exactly who's calling the shots. As they used to say, I think it was in Denmark, a fish stinks from the head down. You look at the board of directors, and then you look at the editorial policy of the Media Outlook, and you say, well, it's no wonder they're saying what they say. Look who's sitting on the board.
And even more than that, there's a wonderful book written by Professor Ben Bechdek of the University of California in Berkeley. It's called The New Media Monopoly. He simply points out that five mega corporations dominate the media and largely control what we think. Now, does the CIA have journalists planted in the media? Of course they do. How do we know that? Well, the book written by Lieutenant General William Odom, entitled Fixing Intelligence, came out in 2003, and certainly General Odom should know. He headed NSA, National Security Agency, or also known as No Such Agency, the most secret of all secret agencies. And in his book, Fixing Intelligence, written 2 years ago, he asked the question, should the CIA have journalists planted in the media? He can't tell you that because he's under security regulations. But, of course, he could ask the question, and I would ask you, should the CIA have journalists planted in the media? And, of course, the answer would be no, not in a free society. But, of course, we really don't have a free society. And I think General Odom knows that. Now, what was the second question, Jack?
Well, in fact, Dr. Stan, your guest tweaked my memory of June of 2003 when Michael Powell of the FTC, interrogated there, stated that the only free speech rights that were of any importance are those of the corporate citizens that he represented, and then they deregulated and allowed them all to, you know, take over. Isn't that true?
Okay, anything else you wanted to say?
No, that's it.
All right, Brian, thanks very much. Let's go to Ray, who's calling from Santa Cruz. Hi, Ray.
Hi, Dr. Stan. My question was, I spoke to a friend from Great Britain, and he was telling me that they had cameras everywhere over there. And I'm just wondering, now, how soon would it be before something like that would happen over here?
All right.
You know, surveillance is, you know, see, I'm confused because I don't understand whether this is international or whether this is just one country.
All right. How would you respond to that, please?
Surveillance, where?
In Great Britain, right.
In Great Britain?
Right.
Yeah.
They have the cameras everywhere over there.
Yeah. Cameras everywhere.
All right, we're gonna have to go to a quick break here. Do you have a comment on that, Patrick?
Well, I think that elements of surveillance, it goes beyond just cameras sitting on a light pole in the city. I think that's probably definitely going to be more frequent, but. The loss of privacy that we have in America now is just astounding. They've got X-ray machines now in testing in certain airports around the country that actually virtually just remove your clothes electronically and show your nude body. You're going to walk through a screening process where they will find out if you have anything hidden anywhere in your body, including in body cavities. It's absolutely astounding.
But Ray, I think that you have to realize they're putting these on the highways.
Yeah,
I know many of the toll roads. I know I was just back east, and we were going onto a toll road, and we didn't have to go through the regular place where you put the money. You just go to the side. You've got something on your car. It's got a little meter on it, and of course they pick up the electronic signal, but they can track that signal all over the highway, every place you drive.
So basically,
they're watching everything. If you've got a cell phone, they're going to be able to track where you are. If you have a car with a global positioning satellite, they can track that. Everything is being tracked today. That's what the war on terror is.
Of course, the electronic chip has to do with that, too.
Sure. Go ahead. Anything else, Ray?
My other question was, now, wouldn't HARP be involved in something like global weather changes and that kind of thing? HARP, the program, CIA, or they're working on changing weather.
Do you want to address that at all, Patrick?
No, I probably shouldn't.
Fine. You can get the four tape set we have on chemtrails, and of course we have a four tape set on HARP, and you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
It's all part of that, but thanks very much for calling me.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. All right, Patrick, well, we're just about out of time. What are your parting thoughts for our listeners tonight?
Well, they need to be vigilant, and they need to be dedicated to engaging these people in active dialogue. I think, there's still room for freedom for public debate in America. I think that people that are able to be articulate need to get armed with the facts, need to get out and get in their face and tell them that they're just flat wrong.
But I think that, of course, they're not going to come on and debate people like you and I. Why should
they,
when they control the media, and most people don't even realize what these people are doing?
I'll tell you, actually, Dr. Stan, Tony Sutton and I regularly debated members of the Trilateral Commission on the radio all over America.
Yeah, that was, of course, 30 years ago.
Anyway,
we're out of time. God bless you, and maybe we can get you on again, and we can talk more about how we're going to try to get them to engage in debate.
Thank you. I'd love to do that.
All right. Good night. God bless you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we do hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters and helping us as we reach out across America 5 hours every day. On radio, on the Internet, on shortwave, and then certainly by satellite, trying to bring people the news behind the news, the story behind the story. There really is an organized effort to bring about a new world order and a new world religion. The people behind this, of course, are very wealthy and very powerful. And behind that is, of course, a powerful spiritual forces that comes from the dark side. because indeed we are engaged in a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Western civilization. And what most people who
write about this
and talk about this have forgotten is this is truly a spiritual battle being played out on the political, ideological, cultural, financial, economic battlefield. So if you would like to help us, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. We're predominantly listener-supported, and we're dependent upon those of you who believe in what we're doing to help us. And, of course, we're on 60 stations every week. But this, of course, has got to be paid for by people who believe in what we're doing. So if you'd like, of course, to get a free copy of our newsletter, if you'd like to get into who really runs the world today, let me suggest the Occult Hierarchy Part 2 newsletter. It's our June newsletter. Now, you can get that up on our Internet site at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. And just pull down the newsletters. Get the June 2005 newsletter. If you don't have access to the Internet or you'd like to get a newsletter from us, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. We'll be glad to send you that newsletter and hope that you will get the information, that you go to our website, that you'll listen to our programs there on the Internet, because that is the easiest way for us to reach people across America. You can listen to our programs directly or indirectly at RadioLiberty.com for 5 hours a day on the Internet. Then, of course, you can listen to the archives, and you'll get a lot of information. You won't get much else done, but you'll get a lot of information, and we really do have people that will call and tell me they listen 5 hours a day because they're getting information there that they're not going to get from other sources. So if you enjoy understanding what's going on, if you are concerned about your future, your family, your freedom, if you're concerned about future generations, why, please go to our website at www.radioliberty.com and listen to our programs. Tell other people about our programs. Encourage them to listen. Encourage them to listen to our programs on this radio station. Now, we're heard here at the Here's Help Radio Network at 3 o'clock every afternoon, and, of course, at 12:30 every Saturday. If you're in the area where the Here's Help Network is being broadcast, why, please tell others. And then, of course, pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders, and please pray for our ministers, but pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so, until tomorrow, when we'll be back with you on the same station once again, Dr. Stan, goodbye, and may the Lord be with you.